Hi there. If you're hearing this, it means you haven't yet upgraded to the Misfit feed. Founders is a private subscription-only podcast. This feed that you're currently on just has about half of every episode. So if you want to listen to full episodes, you'd have to upgrade to the Misfit feed. The way you do that is by tapping the link that's in the show notes on your podcast player. Today it's going to be a little different. Before I play today's preview, which is about the biography of one of Nike's co-founders, I want to tell you how why I read the book. Normally, I at the beginning of every episode, I like to talk about how I found the book. A lot of them come, you know, they're recommendations from listeners. Sometimes I find them, you know, on social media or other places. This one, I found this book actually, or the idea to find this book, I should say, because I was rereading my highlights from the book Shoe Dog, which is one of the best autobiographies I've ever read. It's from the founder of Nike, talks about the founding story of Nike. It goes in chronological order all the way up to the IPO. It's absolutely a fantastic book. And as I was rereading the highlights, I was reminded how Phil Knight talked about his one-time coach, and then his co-founder and his business partner at Nike. So what I want to do today for this, before I get into the preview, is read you the quotes that I read that made me realize, hey, if Phil Knight, which is one of the greatest entrepreneurs to ever live, learned from and admired Bill Bowerman, then why shouldn't we as well? And so this is what all the quotes I'm going to read to you actually come from Shoe Dog, and they're directly from Phil Knight. He says, "The best teacher I ever had, one of the finest men I ever knew, spoke of the Oregon Trail often. It's our birthright, he'd growl. Our character, our fate, our DNA. The cowards never started, he'd tell me, and the weak died along the way. That leaves us." Next quote, "Bowerman was a genius coach, a master motivator, a natural leader of young men, and there was one piece of gear he deemed crucial to their development, shoes. He was obsessed with how human beings are shod over and over again," and Phil Knight talks about there would be no Nike if there wasn't a Bill Bowerman. "Lightness, Bowerman believed, directly translated to less burden, which meant more energy, which meant more speed, and speed equaled winning. Bowerman didn't like to lose. I got it from him. Thus, lightness was his constant goal. It's possible that everything I did in those days was motivated by some deep yearning to impress, to please Bowerman. Besides my father, there was no man whose approval I craved more. And besides my father, there was no man who gave it less often. Frugality carried over to every part of the coach's makeup. He weighed and hoarded words of praise like uncut diamonds." And now after spending the biography on Bowerman's, you know, 420 pages, something like that, spending so much time studying, it just makes me laugh, because you get a good, as you read the book, and hopefully if you listen to the whole podcast, you get a good sense of who he was as a person. And just like Phil Knight came to love and admire him, you know, spending 20-something hours having a one-sided conversation about the entire life of Bill Bowerman, I found at the end, I felt the same way. Let me go back to the quotes from Shoe Dog, though. He says, "Bowerman didn't give a damn about respectability. He possessed a prehistoric strain of maleness. Today, it's all but extinct. He was a war hero, too. Of course he was." I didn't even cover that on the podcast. There's so much. His life was, I said on the podcast, though, it's hard to believe how one person achieved all the things that Bowerman achieved in his lifetime. Going back to Shoe Dog, "I loved Bowerman and feared him, and neither of these initial impulses ever went away. Sometimes the fear was less, sometimes more. Sometimes it went right down to my shoes, which he'd probably cobbled with his bare hands." Interesting enough, the early days of Nike, it's called Blue Ribbon Sports at the time, but the very first prototypes that turned into Nike shoe, what would soon be a Nike shoe, was actually handmade by Bill Bowerman. "Love and fear, the same binary emotions governed the dynamic between me and my father. I wondered sometimes if it was a mere coincidence that Bowerman and my father, both cryptic, both alpha, both inscrutable, were both named Bill." So those are by far the two main male influences of Phil Knight's life. Though only a few more. "The most famous track coach in America, Bowerman never considered himself a track coach." I love this. "He detested being called coach. He called himself a professor of competitive responses." And this was very, very fascinating. He talks about, like, I'm not just a track and field coach. The same lessons that you're going to learn on how to run faster and how to do good at your sport can be applied later in life to your craft, to whatever. He talks about in the book, you know, Bowerman had a bunch of people that came to him with business opportunities, he turned them all down. And he said the reason that he decided to partner with Phil Knight is because he knew that Phil would chase this goal with the, I think, the ceaselessness of a runner. So anyways, let me finish this. He says he called himself a professor of competitive responses, and his job as he saw it and often described it was to get you ready for the struggles and competitions that lay ahead, meaning way after your time in college. I love that idea. Despite this lofty mission, or perhaps because of it, the facilities of, oh, this is hilarious, the facilities at Oregon were Spartan. We had dank wooden walls, lockers that hadn't been painted in decades. The lockers had no door, just slats to separate your stuff from the next guy's. We hung our clothes on nails, rusty nails. We sometimes ran without socks. Complaining never crossed our minds. We saw our coach as a general, to be obeyed quickly and blindly. Listen to his description. This is hilarious to me. In my mind, he was Patton with a stopwatch. That is, when he wasn't a god. He tested me. He broke me down and remade me, just like a pair of shoes. And I had held up. And then this is the final one. Amid the booming silence, I kept my eyes on the road and mulled over Bowerman's eccentric personality, which carried over to everything he did. He always went against the grain. Always. And I think that's part of why learning from Bowerman is so important, because he was one of the few people, and most people I cover on the podcast, they think from first principles, where most people we meet in our day-to-day lives, you know, reason by analogy. And it's very hard for somebody to go against the grain. Bowerman didn't give a damn what other coaches thought. He discovered truth through his own trial and error, and he realized, hey, if there's a better way to train my athletes, then I'm going to do this. I don't care if 90% of my peers are doing something different. So let me go back to this. He always went against the grain, always. For example, he was the first college coach in America to emphasize rest, to place as much value on recovery as on work. So that's the end of the quotes that I found from Shoe Dog. And so when I thought about this, I was like, well, if Phil Knight speaks so highly of this person and he learned from them, like, why wouldn't I? And so that would just made it a no-brainer for me to go ahead and find a biography. The biography that I talk about on this podcast actually was written by a former Bowerman athlete. So it's not an autobiography, because obviously Bowerman's not writing it, but he wrote the book with Bowerman's cooperation towards the end of Bowerman's life. And it was just really, really fantastic. Can't recommend it enough. Hopefully you like the preview and you decide to upgrade. If you want to upgrade, just tap the link that's in your show notes. It takes less than a minute to set up. You listen to the Misfit feed in your favorite podcast player, just like any other podcast. There's no ads. I don't waste any of your time. I start talking to you immediately about what I learned from reading whatever book that I happen to read that week, and then when I'm finished, it just ends. I think a lot about never wasting your time and making sure you're getting a lot of value back from the time that we spend together. Okay, that's it for me. Hope you enjoy the preview, and I hope I see you on the Misfit feed. Bowerman seemed to have been through some mythic struggle. He spit when someone called him coach. "Just call me Bill," he said. But few would or could at first. This accorded with why we were here. We were to be cultivated, refined. Bowerman was about to ask us to put aside the things of a child. Not by accident did he begin. "Men of Oregon, take a primitive organism, any weak, pitiful organism, say a freshman. Make it lift, or jump, or run. Let it rest. What happens? A little miracle. It gets a little better. It gets a little stronger, or faster, or more enduring. That's all training is. Stress, recover, improve. You would think any damn fool could do it, but you won't. You work too hard, and you rest too little, and you get hurt. You yield to the temptations of a liberal education and burn your candle at both ends, and then you get mono. Every angelic, lying face I see here is poised to screw up, to overtrain, to fall in love, to flunk out. We have no hard and fast training rules. The vicissitudes of life usually teach an intelligent person what he can handle. It does help to have someone wise in the ways of candles to steady you as you grope toward the light. That would be me. But I regret to inform you," he added, his tone not the least regretful, "you cannot just tell somebody what's good for him. He won't listen. He will not listen. first, you have to get his attention. Bowerman did not have a central organizing principle. He had this, a central organizing parable. Farmer can't get his mule to plow, he said. Can't even get him to eat or drink. Finally, he calls in a mule skinner. Guy comes out, doesn't even look at the mule. Goes in the barn, gets a 2x4, and hits the mule as hard as he can between the ears. The mule goes to his knees. The mule skinner hits him again between the eyes. The farmer drags him off. That's supposed to get him to plow? That's supposed to get him to drink? I can see you don't know a damn thing about mules, said the skinner. First, you have to get their attention. In the hush that followed, Bowerman's grin was not far from fiendish. This was his allegory, his rationale, his fair warning. He was our mule skinner, and all he would do to us constituted the 2x4 he would use to crack open our mulish skulls so the lessons might be inserted. Leaving that first meeting, I felt only baffled disquiet. Even men who had trained under him for years were edgy. Bowerman, one of them said, is ruled by a need to unsettle, to disturb. The man lives to get you. That was an excerpt from the book that I want to talk to you about today, which is Bowerman, the story of Oregon's legendary coach and Nike's co-founder, and it was written by Kenny Moore. Okay, so before I jump into the book, I want to tell you how I came, why I selected this book to cover this week. I was actually rereading through my highlights from Phil Knight, the founder, co-founder of Nike, his book Shoe Dog. I covered it, I think, back on Founders number 10. And I forgot, I read the book, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. And as I was reading through my notes, I forgot how important Bowerman was to Phil Knight and to the founding of Nike and how much Phil Knight admired him. I want to read one quote, one paragraph from Shoe Dog to you. And then, and that really pushed me over the edge to try to find a biography and made me really excited to dive deeper into the life and the career and the ideas of Bill Bowerman. He's an extremely accomplished individual. So this is Phil Knight writing in Shoe Dog about his one-time coach and then business partner. I look back over the decades and see him toiling in his workshop, Mrs. Bowerman carefully helping, and I get goosebumps. He was Edison in Menlo Park, Da Vinci in Florence, Tesla in Wardenclyffe, divinely inspired. I wonder if he knew, if he had any clue that he was the, I think you pronounce it Daedalus, the Daedalus of sneakers, that he was making history, remaking an industry, transforming the way athletes would run and stop and jump for generations. I wonder if he could conceive in that moment all that he had done, all that would follow. I know I couldn't. And one of the great things about Shoe Dog is, I wish all biographies were formatted very similarly. He does not spend a lot of time on his ancestors. He talks about his early life, where he came up with the idea from Nike. And then every chapter is in, the name of the chapter is the year. And he goes through chronological order from the very prehistory of Nike all the way up until it IPOs and then it ends. And as a byproduct of the way it's structured is, it's what I think most people find most interesting about reading biographies, and that's the struggle, the early life, how they came up with the idea, what they had to go through to actually accomplish and to succeed at what they were doing. So when I read that paragraph, I also had to look up the that word that he was saying, that he was the Daedalus of sneakers. Or I don't know how to, I'm most likely mispronouncing it, but it comes from Greek mythology, and it says in Greek mythology, Daedalus was a skillful architect, craftsman, and artist, and was seen as a symbol of wisdom, knowledge, and power. And I think the fact that Phil Knight used that word, is a description of the way he saw the role Bowerman played. He said over and over again that there would be no Nike without Bowerman. So let me just read that part to you. I wonder if he knew, if he had any clue that he was the Daedalus of sneakers, that he was making history, remaking an industry, transforming the way athletes would run and stop and jump for generations. I wonder if he could conceive in that moment all that he had done, all that would follow. I know that I couldn't. Okay, so that sets up how important he was. The guy lived an amazing life, and he's a really interesting person. I'm going to go ahead and jump into the book. I want to start with the author. So Kenny Moore was one of Bowerman's athletes. And so there's this great story that gives you a good sense of who Bowerman was as the person. So first is a quote at the beginning of the chapter, and it's some guy, I don't even know who it is, but this is the quote. It says, "A guru gives us himself and then his system. A teacher gives us his subject and then ourselves." So remember that word teacher, because that's the way Bowerman thought of himself. He hated the word coach. He did not consider himself a coach. All right, so let me read this section to you, and it gives you an insight into the relationship that and the impact that Bowerman had on the author of this book, Kenny Moore. "In the spring of 1964, Bill Bowerman gave me his subject and stood back to see if I deserved it. Bowerman, then 53, had coached 6 sub-4-minute milers at the University of Oregon and had won the 1962 NCAA Track and Field Championship. I was 20, just finishing my first training run after being out with the flu. He put 2 fingers on my neck, taking my pulse from my carotid artery. Easy day, he asked. Easy day, absolutely, I said. 12 miles, he said, as if he were my physician. He tilted my head back so he could look me in the eye. He was 6'2" and 200 pounds with a powerful upper body. An easy 12, I said. Are you in this simply to do mindless labor, he said, or do you want to improve? To improve? Well, you can't improve if you're always out sick or injured. I know, but Bill, that was an easy 12. He closed great calloused hands around my throat. He did not lift me off the ground, but he did relieve my feet much of their burden. That's hilarious. He brought my forehead to his. I'm going to ask you to take part in an experiment, he said, with menacing calm. For 3 weeks, you are not going to run a yard except in my sight. You will do a 3-mile jog here every morning and our regular afternoon workouts. If I or any of my spies see you trotting another step, you will never run for the University of Oregon again. Bill, are we agreed? Bill, agreed?" As I was feeling faint, I submitted. And so now that I'm going to skip over a couple paragraphs, but this goes into what the main insight, and Phil Knight also talks about this in Shoe Dog, was that Bowerman was not only one of the most successful track coaches that ever lived, but he was also decades ahead of putting an importance, just as much importance on your recovery as on your training and your actual days of competition. And there's a lot of metaphors in this book where Bill's talking about optimizing performance for athletes that I think are transferable to whatever it is that you do for work. So, and one of them is the idea that you can't burn yourself out, that to achieve great things, you have to be able to do those things over a long period of time. And so I would summarize, and I don't want to, summary is not the right word. I would say that Bowerman would agree in part with the statement that consistency over intensity. This is what he's talking about here, where this guy is, where Kenny's running, you know, he's not healed all the way. He's still a little sick. His resting heart rate's too high. And Bowerman's, what he'll prioritize is rest and recovery. Yes, just like he was giving the speech I started the podcast with. That was a speech he'd give that speech at the beginning of every track season. Talking about, you know, it's very simple. Stress, recovery, growth. Okay, so it says, "It was the easy days that were humiliating. Reporting to Bowerman morning and evening on track, having him count my laps, barely feeling warmed up before he called, 3 miles, go in. I did not suffer this gladly." So he talks about like any highly competitive, you know, these are, Phil Knight's no different, Bowerman's no different, Kenny Moore's no different. These are type A super driven people. So this is extremely hard to realize that you may get farther by doing less. And it's not to be confused with being lazy. Bowerman didn't have a lazy bone in his body. This guy's an insane person, as you'll get to know him today. So he says, "I did not suffer this gladly." We're going to see the initial reaction. You know, this is 1960s when this is happening. This is a very common reaction that Bowerman would get, not only from athletes, but from other coaches too, until he started kicking all their asses. "I did not suffer this gladly. I was tempted to do secret, defiant runs, but he had enlisted the rest of the team in half the town. Every friend was a possible traitor, and the potential cost was too great. No one who knew Bill Bowerman doubted he would back up his ultimatum. No one who knew me doubted that I desperately wanted to be an Oregon runner." Moving forward, this was very, very interesting. I guess I'll tell you right up front. Bowerman prioritized the individual. And we're going to see that a lot of his thoughts were around that you have to tailor your teaching, your coaching, the training program to the individual. There's not like a lot of, it's not very black and white. There's a lot of like customization. But he talks about the people that he does not want to coach or that he does not want to teach. So he says, in theory, as a coach, he should have been as interested in motivating the lazy as mellowing the mad, but he wasn't. He regarded the most frustrating athlete as the gifted but casual, the gifted but casual as beyond any real help. So this is somebody, you know, is very talented, got by, had such an abundance of talent, maybe was really smart, that he didn't have to work as hard. And so this is what he says. He would juggle their roommates to give them an example of ambition, but took no further steps to inspire. He never gave a pep talk. I'm sorry, I can't make them switch brains, he said, but I can't. And this is the most important sentence, and the note I left myself is just a hell of a sentence. That left him free to be absorbed by the eager. And so I would say the way Bowerman, like why is that section important? Because he doesn't believe motivation is his job. Like if you're a driven individual, like you, the motivation comes from, it's internal, it comes from within. And so his point is like, well, you know, we're making Olympians here. That means you're uncommon amongst uncommon people. So if you don't wake up every day with that drive, then I'm not going to, there's nothing I can say or do to you. He just said, I can't switch your brain. But if you do have that drive, if you have the dedication, then I'll teach you lessons that I've learned that will get the most out of your ability and hopefully bring you to the, you know, to the highest level in the sport or whatever endeavor that you choose. So I thought it was very interesting. And few paragraphs later gives us an insight into, you know, how he thought about this. Bowerman thought of himself as an educator. He scorned recruiting and almost never gave full scholarships. Anyone can be taught, he said. Those who don't expect a handout, best of all. I'd sure rather be teaching than blowing smoke up some spoiled brat's ass. Okay, so moving forward, there's a lot of things happening on this page. The author is still giving us some background before we get into the main story. There's two things I want to point out to you here. One, I think I already mentioned this, but Bill Knight said there is no Nike without Bowerman's innovations. He designed, I mean, think about it. He had multiple decades of training some of the best runners, and that's how Nike started out. It started out as a company wanting to make the best running shoes, right? So just a little bit about that. It says, disdainful of the weight and non-existent cushioning of running shoes in the 1950s, he had taken up cobbling and made us 3-ounce spikes that lasted one race. We had no inkling that these were the beginning of Nike's vast success, but we knew we had better shoes than anyone else. And so that's something I also admire, and I'll just tell you right up front about Bowerman, is that there's a quote in that book, The Fish That Ate the Whale, which I never forgot. And it says, if you know your business, it's a quote by the main character of the book, Sam Zamuri. I think it's in Founders, somewhere in the 30s. You can go back and listen to it if you haven't and read the book. It's absolutely crazy, fantastic story. But Sam Zamuri says something. He's like, if you know your business from A to Z, there's no problem you can't solve. And Bowerman had that mindset because he was obsessed with trying to be the best track coach and having the best athletes in the world. And so not only would he want, you know, you had to be driven, you had to be naturally talented, you had to be receptive to his lessons, but he would make his, like, he started cobbling, started making his own shoes. How many track coaches in the world could do that? It's just insane. And he didn't stop there. Then he starts designing clothes. He starts making some of the clothes out of like the same material parachutes are made out of. He would take like, I think it might be nylon or whatever whatever the actual fabric was, but I do know he used like old parachutes and started like sewing clothes. He did that, so he'd take care of your shoes, what you're wearing. He eventually starts experimenting later on with different mixtures of what tracks are made out of. And so at his house on the top of a hill, top of a mountain, you know, he's got a cement mixer, the equivalent of like a cement mixer. He's doing all this trying to figure out what's the best way I can, like, what's the best material? Maybe there's a better track I can make so we can go faster. He was completely obsessed. He knew his business, so to speak, from A to Z. So this goes, I rolled my eyes. Now we're talking about, the author's talking about, you know, wanting to push more, and Bowerman trying to temper that natural instinct to just overwork, because it's not that he didn't want you to push. He does not want you to get injured, because if you get injured, you might be out the entire year. You can't get that back. So he says, I rolled my eyes at Bowerman's patient studies of our strides and metabolism, and especially his damn easy days. That's what he was talking about. He's like, hey, you're only going to jog 3 miles and that's it. as an example of an easy day. It felt demeaning to just rest. So the reason I include this in the podcast, because these next two sentences is exactly what Bowerman had. This was the way everybody thought about athletics at the time. And so that's what makes Bill Bowerman so interesting. One of the things that makes him so interesting is that he was willing to think from first principles. And if he arrived at a different conclusion he thought was right, it didn't matter if 90% of the people in his field were doing it the other way. And he winds up being correct. So he says, it felt demeaning to just rest. Work was righteous. Rest was weak-willed and ignoble. But Bowerman understood that paradox. The need for both abandoned effort and ironclad control. And finally, Bowerman's message starts to get through. We're still in the introduction. I know I'm in trouble because I have a ton of highlights in this book. I really enjoyed it, and I'll tell you the impact it had me had on me personally at the very end. He had given me his subject. I had found myself. It finally began to penetrate my thick skull that I had to rise above the world's fixation with sheer work. I had to tend to my own eccentric physiology. I accepted easy days into my life, and I stopped counting miles. Over the next 8 years, the one long run he permitted me every 10 days would turn me into a fourth place finisher in the 1972 Olympic marathon. It was the lesson of my life, and it forces me now to consider, with a shiver, whether anyone besides Bowerman could have gotten through to me. Okay, so now I want to get a little bit into the personality to give you an idea of who this person was. One huge part of his personality, he's very laconic. He keeps his thoughts to himself. He's not up there, some coaches you might expect they're giving a pep talk, giving a motivational speech. He preferred one-on-one. That's part of the reason he started out as a football coach and gravitated towards track because, even though there's a team, you can deal with your athletes on a one-on-one basis. So that was his preferred method. But he says he spent long hours in contented silence, solving a huge range of problems, and he was brutally eloquent when dissecting other psyches. Yet he kept the process of himself to himself. As Barbara Bowerman, that's his wife, they were married for 70 years. By the time he dies at 88, she had known him for 70 years. As Barbara Bowerman would recall, I can't tell you how frustrating it was to love him and trust him and know he loved me and trusted me, and still he would never tell me what he was thinking. His family, they got to Oregon by crossing the Oregon Trail, something that he spoke of often. And this quote that he's going to have here in a minute just makes me laugh every time. It's also in Shoe Dog. But he says, almost all who traveled the Oregon Trail were on the only trip of their lives. It was a defining ordeal, a winnowing out of the non-industrious, the non-enduring, the inflexible, and the uncooperative. Bowerman was pioneer stock and had a right to cackle, as he did, that the cowards never started and the weak died along the way. That leaves us. So that gives you an insight into some of his personality. This story from when he was a young boy will also give you an insight into his desire to live life on his own terms. One of the things I most admire about him. On the first day of first grade, the teacher asked, "Can you write your name?" Bill cried out, "That's what I came here to learn." An early warning that he meant to go through life on his own terms. So it talks about he grew up in this tiny, tiny town. I think it was like a population of like 500. It's called Fossil, Oregon. And I just want to read one sentence from this. He seemed to imply that he was so fired by his own wild yearnings, so temper-torn, that obedience had been impossible. The ranch life of Fossil taught its children to close off no options, to presume nothing is impossible. In his approach to the world, he would take stock, give nothing away, circle to different vantage points, and keep an eye out for a sign of something he might exploit. That's actually a really good one-sentence summary of his approach to life. So an early Bill Bowerman was like a hellraiser. His dad dipped out, left his family for his secretary, didn't have anything to do with really raising his kids at all. Bowerman had a twin brother that was killed right in front of him when he was real young, maybe 5, 6 years old, something like that. And he was crushed in an elevator accident. He got into fights. He was very disobedient, just a crazy, uncontrollable kid. And that changed one day when he meets his mule skinner. And this person has a huge impact on the trajectory of his life. Not very different than the way Bowerman would influence the trajectory of the people that like his athletes. So he's getting in trouble. He's waiting outside of the principal's office. And it says, then, as Bowerman himself would always remember, the voice emanated from the inner sanctum. Is that hell-raising son of a bitch still out there? Ursel Hedrick was then 30. He had graduated from Oregon in 1916 and been a World War I Marine, mule skinner, and artillery officer. Standing above a stack of Bill's teacher reports, he said, I think Bill at this time is 15 or 16, around that age. This is ridiculous. You're good in band, good in journalism, so you're not stupid. You're just a hell-raising son of a bitch. Bowerman, Hedrick went on, here's how life is going to go for you. You'll keep up this goddamn fighting, and you'll not only be out of Medford, that's where the school he's at, you'll be out of goddamn everywhere. So he got suspended and almost expelled multiple times because he just could not stop getting fistfights. Nobody is going to stand for this shit, and that's the way it should be. You'll fight, and I'll be rid of you. You'll fight, and everybody else will be rid of you. Fight here, fight there, die in prison or on some barroom floor. I could give a royal oozing shit. That's justice. That's just dying by your own goddamn sword. And this is where he gets his attention. Remember the whole, he starts off, he's like, listen, I'm only here. The first thing you have to do before I can teach you is I have to get your attention. I have to make sure you have an open mind so my lessons can actually get in. And this is what Ursel, Ursel's doing for him right here. And he gets him with this sentence. The only thing wrong with that, meaning dying, dying in a fight in a barroom, is that you'll dishonor a goddamn worthwhile human being. Bill's head came up. Who? Elizabeth Hoover Bowerman. Bill stopped breathing. You will bring eternal shame upon the name of your mother, Hendrick said. What should I do? Bill finally croaked. What do you want me to do? Control yourself, roared Hedrick. Cut the crap and channel that goddamn energy. Go back to that school and be of use. Make your mother proud. Because I swear to you, Bowerman, I never want to hear your goddamn name again. And so this is the result after this talk. He began to channel. Systematically, he threw himself into his studies, sports, the band, drama, and the school paper. Hedrick's 2x4 between his eyes would be the lesson of his life. Hedrick got my attention. That's Bill. That's a quote from Bill 50 years after this happened. That's insane. That he, you know, think about how important this was in his life that you could remember it 5 decades later. Whether Bill swore to himself that he would never lose control again isn't known. But this was the beginning of the self-possession. Another word to think about is discipline that Bowerman definitely has over himself, self-discipline. The beginning of the self-possession that would strike anyone who met him thereafter. Bill's turnaround was so dramatic that Hedrick would, in fact, hear his goddamn name again. But instead of hell-raising and fighting, it's because he winds up being a world-famous coach. And one of the best to ever do what he did. So moving forward, I think one we've seen this several times, that seeing something done the wrong way can be, sometimes you learn more from seeing something done the wrong way than you even do by seeing it done the right way. And he realizes that he's got a terrible football coach, and he's like, I want to be the opposite of this guy. And that leads him to finding what I would say like his blueprint, the person that he follows. So he says, Bill at once grasped the nature of his head coach. Doc Spears was dictatorial, abrasively vocal, and resembled a bloodthirsty infantry commander. The varsity had a good team almost in spite of him, Bowerman would recall. He was cruel, and he was a windbag. He has, to this day, says Bowerman has an intense dislike of blowhards. The man's bellowing insistence on being called coach turned Bill against the word forever. So it goes, that gives you an insight into why he refused to want to be called coach. So he winds up meeting so that's the football coach. He winds up meeting a track coach. And it's this guy named Bill Hayward who winds up becoming Bowerman's blueprint. And so it says, they start talking, and he says, but I hear people call you Colonel, said Bill Bowerman. Well, just call me Bill. Remember, that's how he started out, how he started giving the speech to the track team at the beginning of the year. You know, don't call me coach, just call me Bill. Just call me Bill, said Oregon's head athletic trainer and track coach, 62-year-old Bill Hayward. Hayward had invented state-of-the-art splints, casts, straps, pads, slings, and braces to keep injured bodies in the lineup and allow them some movement and protection while they healed. The devices fascinated Bowerman. And the note I left myself on that page, and the reason I'm including that here is because that's exactly... Bowerman does the same thing at Nike. He's making things to go faster, but he also does it for protection to make sure you don't get injured. Very much so, he copied a lot of Haywood's ideas. In fact, when they want to later on in life, they want to induct Bowerman into the Track and Field Hall of Fame. And he refused. He says, I'm not going in until you induct Haywood in first. So it gives you an idea of the level of respect and the love that he had for his coach. And so I'm going to read you some description of Haywood, but essentially I'm doing this so you learn about Bowerman, because he copied this to the T. Haywood declared his personal life off limits. We dilute the word and usually demean the subject when we call someone a character, but Haywood's eccentricity invited it, and he didn't seem to mind. Remember, everything I'm reading to you applies to Bowerman. Haywood wasn't especially fatherly towards his charges, towards his athletes, and treated each one differently. Characteristics Bill Bowerman would emulate. Haywood also preceded Bowerman in being a practical joker. And so they start spending a great deal of time together. As they're spending time together, Haywood's just telling him, essentially, he's filling him in on the history of the sport. He says, listening to these litanies of the great, it dawned on Bill that Haywood had enabled, witnessed, or photographed about two-thirds of Olympic track and field history. There was no more experienced village elder if the village was the Olympic ones. This is something that Bowerman was going to wanted to aspire to. Because of what he taught me, Bowerman would say, I went from one of the slowest players on the team to the second fastest. Bill was grateful to have a guide to good form in his career as well as his stride. But he also came to revere Haywood because he was logical. It is not just a condensation of hindsight to say that sports in the 1930s was a mishmash of ignorance. Talks about different coaches put arbitrary authority ahead of common sense. Haywood, by contrast, looked for the underlying reasons. This is really going to hone in on the way Bowerman approached his craft. Again, I would say he tried to think of things from first principles. He was not willing to just accept the dogma of his sport, of his day. And by questioning that, he went finding ways where the accepted dogma was inaccurate and where he could improve on it. It's very interesting. Haywood, by contrast, looked for the underlying reasons. He applied almost all his lessons to himself. Tiny changes made all the difference. This fit in with Bill's growing interest in the sciences and what we now term biomechanics, how the levers are moved by the muscles, how the body properly aligned performs at its optimum. That's his entire life work, right? Haywood was half doctor, half inventor. You could say the same thing about Bowerman. Bowerman began to mold himself into one tune. I learned from the master, he would say. Thanks for making it to the end of this preview. If you want to continue listening to the full episode, you'll need to upgrade to the Misfit feed. By upgrading, you'll get access to every full episode that I've ever done. These episodes are available nowhere else. And as a bonus, you also get lifetime access to my notebook that contains key insights from over 285 podcasts and lectures on entrepreneurship. As a way to illustrate why it is so important for you to learn the lessons from all the biographies that I analyze on the Misfit feed, I have some quotes that I've collected from other people who have discovered the value in reading biographies, and they explain to you and I why this activity is so valuable. So the first quote comes from the founder of Shopify, Toby Lutke, and he says, books are the closest you will ever come to finding cheat codes for real life. You can access the entire learnings of someone else's career in a few hours. This quote from Mark Andreessen on why he reads biographies. There are thousands of years in history in which lots and lots of very smart people worked very hard and ran all types of experiments on how to create new businesses and invent new technology. They ran these experiments throughout their entire lives. At some point, somebody put these ideas down in a book. For very little money and a few hours of time, you can learn from someone's accumulated experience. There is so much more to learn from the past than we often realize. You could productively spend your time reading experiences of great people who have come before you and learn every time. And finally, this quote from the book, The Tao of Charlie Munger, on why Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett have both read hundreds of biographies in their lifetime. Reading personal biographies allows ones to experience multiple lives and successes and failures. Reading business biographies allows one to experience the vicissitudes of a business and learn how problems were solved. Both Charlie and Warren are copious readers of personal and business biographies. So upgrade now by tapping the link that's in your show notes on your podcast player or going to founderspodcast.com.